I run the risk this morning of relating an incident in the life of Christ, which you probably heard many times as a child, but which I hope you will hear again with pleasure because it presents him in such an appealing way. Not as a wonder worker, suspending the laws of nature, but as a personality so radiant and so eager to see the best in people that he often worked remarkable changes in their lives. If there is one Bible story no Sunday school kid ever forgets, it's the one about the short guy who climbs a tree and gets the biggest surprise of his life. Now, just for fun, if you also know with absolute certainty what his name was, and remember, God is watching, please hold up your hands. If you're sure you know his name, whoa, what a tepid response. Well, all right. With the confident voices born of such esoteric knowledge on the part of only a handful, when I have counted to three, I want that handful to please speak his name in unison. One, two, three.
Zacchaeus.
Ah, that's great. The sermon this morning is going to remember Zacchaeus and what his dramatic encounter with a young Jewish prophet named Jesus tells us about the basic message of the gospel. Here is the setting for that encounter. Jesus is on his final journey to Jerusalem when he stops at one of the oldest cities on earth, a place called Jericho, deep in the Jordan River Valley. I suppose you could call it the Palm Springs of ancient Judea, a subtropical city famous for its dates and figs and bananas, for its fragrant balsam and rose gardens, such a welcome oasis in that parched land that the Bible refers to it as the Garden of the Lord and as the City of Palm Trees. The Roman general, Mark Antony, hopelessly bewitched by Cleopatra, gave her the city of Jericho as a present, and then threw the country of Arabia in to boot, which makes Richard Burton's great diamond for his Cleopatra, Elizabeth Taylor, look pale by comparison. All sorts of traders and caravans moved through biblical Jericho, jostling for room in its narrow, dusty streets with pilgrims, priests, robbers, and soldiers. It was an ideal place, this frontier post, for the Romans to station internal revenue agents. And our friend Zacchaeus was one of these. In fact, he was the head man at the Jericho office of the Roman IRS. Tax collectors have never been very popular anywhere, and in Palestine in the time of Christ, they were especially despised because they not only represented an occupation army, but they were widely viewed as traitors and robbers who charged an extra 10% or more above what Rome demanded from them and then tucked the surcharge away into their own pockets. When Luke says, telling this story offhandedly, that Zacchaeus is a rich man, he probably means to hint that as contractor in chief of the local tax agency, the way he got to be rich was by cheating. Back in the 18th century, when tax collectors were milking France for all they could get, a group of Parisians were amusing themselves one day by recalling stories of great robbers in their history. The philosopher Voltaire was present, and after a while he said, "I can tell a thief's story better than any of yours." When they begged to hear it, he began, "Once upon a time, there was a tax collector," and then he paused. They said, "Please go on. We're eager to hear the name and to hear this tale of your greatest thief." Voltaire said, "I've already told it. Don't you see that my mention of a tax collector implies the greatest thief story in history?" Well, the people in Palestine, when Jesus was alive, would have understood that perfectly. They detested tax collectors, and they spoke of them in the same breath with cutthroats and thieves, traitors and brothel keepers. As you can imagine, tax collectors had a very limited social life. It would be logical to assume that on the day we are remembering, the revenue agent named Zacchaeus notices a commotion at the edge of town and asks a man racing to join it, "What's happening?" Without stopping to be seen in the company of such an outcast, the man shouts back over his shoulder that the young prophet Jesus from the hill country up in Galilee is passing through town. And Zacchaeus decides he'd like to see what this celebrity looks like. If he had any motive beyond curiosity, we're not told. But it's possible he had heard that this Jewish prophet was not as harsh and judgmental as many of them were, that in fact he had accepted as one of his closest followers an IRS agent named Matthew. Since law-abiding Jews shunned their disloyal brothers, tax collectors probably got together with other tax collectors when they traveled around the country. And Zacchaeus may have had a friend who told him stories like these: how when Agent Matthew left his toll booth to follow Jesus, there was a dinner party where, as the gospel record puts it, a good many tax collectors and other disreputable people came on the scene and joined Jesus and his disciples. And how when the Pharisees, those loyal, rigid church people of the time, saw this, they said to the disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with trash like this?" And how the prophet Jesus told them it was his mission to help people who really needed help, that he had come to offer forgiveness and a new life to the very dregs of society, and that these critical Pharisees needed, great Bible students that they were, to go off someplace and learn what their scriptures meant when they quoted God as saying, "I prefer mercy to ritual and sacrifice." A word about those Pharisees before we pick up the story again. Their name means the separated ones, a way of distancing themselves from people who were not as strict about religion as they were. They were sincere and passionate people who meant well, but who easily became intolerant and unforgiving of those who were not as rigid as they were. They remind me, in many ways, of groups like the Moral Majority and the Christian Coalition, what is often called the far right in religion, people sure they have all the right answers to complex questions and all the right solutions for complex social issues, an attitude that, in spite of other good qualities, often leads to an arrogant self-righteousness hard for others to take. I'm reminded of the time it was Kindness to Animals Week at the elementary school, and how exhilarated and full of pride the third grader was when he came home one day. His mother noticed and wondered why. He told her that the students in his class had agreed that each one of them would do something special that week to be kind to animals. He said that what he had done had really worked. "Well, that's nice," his mother said. "What did you do?" "I saw a second grader kick his dog, so I beat him up." This is what I call fierce righteousness, the kind some people get when they start thinking their cause is so important that it's okay to suspend decency and goodwill in order to get the job done. This is the distortion that causes ordinarily good people to excuse ridicule, innuendo, and outright slander in pursuit of what they are positive is an ultimate good. It keeps turning out, however, that fierce righteousness is not righteous at all. It's only fierce. And it spoils the good intended by it. We've heard a lot of it lately, but it's nothing new. Many of the Pharisees of the first century had fallen into that trap. And Jesus was in trouble with these people all the time because he posed more questions than he answered, because he put far more emphasis on human relationships than on their rituals and ceremonies, and because while their idea was salvation by segregation, his was salvation by association, mingling with down and out people that the righteous refused even to look at. If Zacchaeus had ever heard any of this about Jesus, having suffered so long from insults and name-calling, he might well have been curious to see a preacher who was different. For all we know of this brief meeting, he may have grown desperately weary of his reputation, wishing he had back somehow the things that now seemed so irretrievably lost: peace, dignity, self-respect. Whatever was at work in this man, he rushes out to see what the popular young prophet is like in person. But he has a problem. Luke tells us that, being a very short man, Zacchaeus cannot see Jesus over the heads of the crowd. And certainly no one in this crowd will be sympathetic or move for him if he tries to push his way through. So he decides to run ahead of them down the road and climb a tree. It's really an odd moment in Scripture. It seems such an inconsequential detail. It seems so vivid and concrete. It's not at all like the way most of the New Testament is written. It isn't hard to imagine how people laugh when they see what's happening. I can hear some bearded Jewish shopkeeper muttering to his son, "Look at that sawed-off little thief scrambling up the sycamore tree to get a look at a prophet of God, and him with a heart as hard as a grindstone. You'd think he'd be ashamed to show his face." We could get lucky, of course. He might just fall out on his head and leave us in peace for a while. What happens next surprises everybody. When Jesus reaches that tree, he stops, looks up, and calls Zacchaeus by name. Luke probably attributes his knowing that name because of some supernatural insight, but there may be a simpler explanation. Jesus may have heard people making fun of Zacchaeus and calling his name, or he may have seen a longing in the man's face that no one else had cared enough to notice. In any event, he stops and speaks to Zacchaeus. You can be sure that the crowd giggles quietly, anticipating how much fun it will be to hear the prophet of God tell Zacchaeus that he's probably as close to heaven up in that tree as he's ever going to get. What Jesus actually says almost knocks them off their feet. "Zacchaeus, hurry up and come down. I plan to be a guest in your house today." In the Bible's curiously compressed way of telling these stories, we're given no hint why Jesus would make such an announcement, why he would risk making everybody in the parade angry by inviting himself to the home of a tax collector. We can only guess at such things because the gospel records, for all their importance, are so incredibly sketchy. There is an old tradition, lovely but almost certainly unreliable, which tries to explain this moment by saying that Matthew, that disciple who had been a tax collector, once told Jesus, "Rabbi, if you ever go through Jericho and have time, there's an old friend I got to know when we were both in the Internal Revenue Service together. And I've often thought if the two of you could meet, well, I used to think sometimes that he would like very much to find a better life for himself." We can probably be sure of one thing. Nothing is likely to have been further from Zacchaeus's mind than that among all the temple priests, the rich and respected citizens of Jericho, this celebrity from Galilee would choose to stay at his home. But whatever lost world of motives and longings may lie back of this incredibly abbreviated story, the fact is that when Zacchaeus hears the invitation of Jesus, he climbs back down as fast as he can and tells Jesus how delighted he will be to have him as a guest. And about that time, a low rumble of irritation goes through the crowd. People begin to mutter, "Can you believe this? Those rumors we've heard must be true, that this man has a habit of running around with reprobates without any regard at all for his reputation. Here we are in the middle of a welcoming parade, and instead of going to the home of a priest or the mayor, he picks out this scumbag to be his host. No true prophet would ever compromise himself by entering the house of that treacherous thief. Does Zacchaeus hear what they're saying? Is that why he suddenly stops and says to Jesus, "Here and now, sir, I give half my property to charity. And if I have cheated anyone, I am ready to repay that person four times over." Talk is cheap, but this is expensive. And Jesus is impressed. "Salvation has come to this house today," he said, "since Zacchaeus here is a son of Abraham." This is not a reference to bloodlines, but to how tall the short man stands at that moment in the sight of God. It's a strange little story with a world of gaps in it and all sorts of unanswered questions, but if it says anything at all, it reminds us that people proud of their goodness. And remember, if this story is to have any conceivable application, we have to think that we are not Zacchaeus. We're on the other side. We're the good people. And we remind ourselves, thinking that we're always being surprised at what can happen on occasion to the shunned and rejected when someone's love and confidence restores their self-respect. The story can be read also, I suppose, as a reminder that opportunities are not infinite. Zacchaeus, whatever his longing may have been, could easily have said, "I think I'll have him in my home when he comes back," and try to get a little more information on him in the meantime. But although he didn't know it, there would not be a next time. Lloyd C. Douglas, congregational minister and novelist, may have captured the essence of this roadside encounter when he wrote this dialogue. "Zacchaeus," said the carpenter gently, "what did you see that made you desire this piece?" "Good master, I saw, mirrored in your eyes, the face of the Zacchaeus I was meant to be." The most important reason for this church to exist is the hope that once in a while, in sermon or in song or through the friendships we make, we catch a glimpse of what we were meant to be.